Hello, and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio, CFBU-FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time, we explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On today's show, we talk about the holiday season from three perspectives: the mass consumerism of the season with a consumer psychologist at Brock. We talk to the university's happiness expert on how to remain positive and upbeat over the holidays. And we find out a bit about the history of the ancient Roman Saturnalia festival that began December 17th. Celebrating the holidays, Inquisitive Minds is on the air. We welcome you to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFBU-FM. The countdown is on. A week today is Christmas Day, and if you are like most of us, you still have Christmas shopping to do. How do you handle the stress of it all? Well, being better armed is one way to cut down on that stress level. Brock Associate Professor of Marketing and Consumer Psychologist Antonia Mantanakis stopped by our CFBU studios recently to talk about some of the traps consumers fall into at this time of year and what we can do to avoid them. And I asked her first if she had all her Christmas shopping done.
No, it's not.
You're making us feel better.
Okay, yeah, good.
Okay. Every year it seems we get caught up in the hoopla and the excitement of the season, only to watch credit card bills come in January and February. And we usually say something at that point like, never again.
Right.
I'm not going to let this happen again. The next year, it happens again. It's inevitable. So what can we do to avoid the big build-up to the holidays and the even worse hangover that we inevitably get in January and February?
That's a really good question. Let's step back a second and think about when this happens to our credit cards, when it's not the holidays. And we can think of times when we walk into a store and we're influenced by the sights and the smells and the sounds. You know, think about even going to the grocery store and you have your grocery list of things you want to get, but the smells of the bakery and the vision of all of the pastries kind of makes you tempted to buy a pastry or a fresh baked loaf of bread because the smell is so enticing that wasn't necessarily on your list. Well, that's what happens during the holidays, but to the extreme. So retailers know this feeling and these sensations that are very tempting to consumers, whether it's the smells of apple cinnamon candles or any kind of scents that could be used in the stores that oftentimes consumers don't even realize are there. And the sounds, the holiday music being played in the mall and in the stores, just gets everybody in that positive mood. And we know when consumers are in a good mood and they feel like they're in that gift-giving attitude, that feeling that they have where they want to share and give gifts, well, they're going to be more likely to spend money and buy things that might not necessarily be on their Christmas list for who they are buying gifts for.
So it's basically designed to make us spend more than we anticipated.
That's right. When a consumer has a set list of, okay, these are the 5 gifts that I need to get at the mall today, it's really easy when you're in that shopping mood and in that positive gift-giving frame of mind to want to also spend money on yourself. And retailers know this. So anytime a consumer is in the store, that's just another opportunity where they can spend more on themselves.
We've all been guilty of that. Okay, I've done all my Christmas shopping. Now I'm going to get something for myself. Nothing wrong with that, so long as you keep it in reason.
Right.
But obviously, they want you to go overboard with everything at this time of the year.
That's right. We have to remember, too, that a consumer is not going to make a purchase if they're not on your website and they're not in your store. They have to have one of those two opportunities and be there. And the holidays are a time when retailers know, well, we can achieve that first obstacle, get the consumer into our stores, because we know they're buying gifts for other people. So if we have them in our store, if we give them these promotions and try to use all of the tactics we can, this is the time of year when retailers will use every one of those tactics that we know about, that I'll talk about, the consumer's going to be more likely to spend money.
We are a consumer-driven economy. We're expected to buy more every year. There's always that question posed to shoppers. You see it on the news. Are you going to spend more or less this year? Inevitably, they will say more. Occasionally, someone will say less. Is today's society simply programmed to spend, no matter what, even if they don't have the wherewithal to pay for it?
I do want to comment on how the trend has been, at least what I've seen in the last 5 years, is that retailers have been starting the holiday promotions and holiday sales earlier and earlier every year, right? So we see Christmas and holiday displays up and Christmas music and holiday carols and things being played in the stores and being used in the stores earlier and earlier than we've seen in the past. And so I think that enticing element of getting consumers in that frame of mind inevitably make them more likely to spend more than they might have in previous years. Because again, they're using the opportunity sooner than they might have in previous years. And so when you're given that opportunity, consumers are more likely to spend. And you know, going back to the point about society we live in today, when we think of all of the options that consumers have now that didn't exist 20 years ago, right? So now consumers have opportunities to buy things online, to customize things, special order. So think about buying a pair of running shoes, for instance. 20 years ago, there was one model that came out each season, and you could get it in your size, maybe one other color if it was available, but that was it. The consumer had to go into the store. I mean, unless it was Sears catalog, the one channel that the consumer had was to go into the store and make a purchase. And again, the catalog option was an option for some retailers, but that was it. Now, consumers have at their fingertips, between when we think about the internet and the vast opportunities there, Amazon.com and other online retailers that are available, going into the store, going to outlet stores. And within that, there's also this mass opportunity for customization. Everything is customizable today for consumers, whether it's customizing your playlist, customizing your running shoes. You know, you can go online to Nike and choose everything from the laces to the insole to the exterior material, colors, and so on. Everything's customizable. So consumers have a lot of the power today to make a choice. And so that puts more pressure on retailers to start earlier, to promote more intensely, and to try to get the consumer's attention in any way they can.
Well, two things though. The earlier they get, the more annoyed I get.
Right.
I don't want to see Christmas decorations in September. But I wonder if the fact that you can go online and, as you say, specify what you want, what you're looking for, does that not also better arm the consumers to know exactly what they want? They can do the comparison shopping in the convenience of their own home on the computer before they even hit the mall.
That's a really interesting point. You would think that that would make a consumer more likely to use that power and exert their self-control and stick to what they really want or what they really need, stick to their Christmas list or their gift list. But oftentimes, consumers don't. And so that's certainly the advice that one would want to give to a consumer, that, okay, you can stick to your list, you can pick anything you want or have something customized the way you want and do your shopping online at home and allocate a certain amount of time so you're not spending more time on the website or searching for other things you might not need. But again, the enticements are there that make consumers spend more time on the website and browse other options. And then there are suggested other purchases that different web services will provide to consumers that just entice them a little bit more, that might make them spend more.
So the spirit could be willing, but the willpower could be weak.
That's right. Yeah.
When they get you into the store, store. What do the stores do to influence your purchases? We touched briefly on this at the beginning of the interview.
Well, again, the first obstacle is overcome when the consumer walks into the store, because now you have the consumer's attention, you have their presence is there. Consumers have an opportunity to make a purchase in your store. And anytime the consumer feels good, so there's this big emotional element in retail. At a very basic level, having everything organized and easy to find is a very basic thing that a retailer can do to make a consumer feel good. They feel like things are familiar and they're comfortable in your store. But now let's take that a little further. There are other things that retailers do to, again, make the consumer feel good. Smells. Any kind of nice, inviting, engaging smell, very subtle, that consumers might not necessarily even realize is something that the retailer is using. That's also used. The music, the sounds. Getting people to, especially when Christmas music is played, that really gets consumers in the positive holiday spirit. Again, that makes a consumer feel good. The more the consumer feels good, the more they're going to linger in your store. And we can think of the opposite of that. I'm sure that we've all walked into a store and the music is not music you like, and it's really loud and it's really crowded, or you can't find what you're looking for, or things just seem cluttered and you feel uncomfortable and you want to leave, right? So around the holidays, retailers have so much more opportunity to do the opposite of that, because they can use the music, they can use scents, they can use different displays that make people feel good. The longer they're in the store, the more likely they're going to want to make a purchase.
I once worked in a classical music store for a number of years, and when I got there, I was told, play Baroque music, because people will buy more if the Baroque music is playing. There was no basis of fact to that statement that I could find, but that was just the impression that the store owner at the time felt, and he says, it just makes them feel good. That's what we do.
I think the store owner was right in the hypothesis that this would actually happen, because there are a couple studies that suggest that music does influence behavior, and music specifically influences consumer behavior. So the one study I'll discuss was published in a very prestigious journal, and I can't remember the authors off the top of my head. The study wasn't done by me, so I want to make sure that the credit goes to the actual authors. The researchers looked at whether the type of music played in a wine store influenced the type of wine that consumers bought. So 1 week they played French music, the next week they played German music, the third week they played French and then German again. And then they just tracked the sales. And similar to what you would hypothesize is that there is a significant increase in sales of French wine when French music was played, and a significant increase in German wine when German music was played. And now there was a research confederate in the store by the exit who would ask the consumers on their way out, oh, what did you purchase today? And consumers would respond and would say, oh, I just bought this wine. And they said, oh, well, why did you buy that particular wine? And consumers would say, oh, I don't know, I just bought it. It looked good, or this looks like a good quality wine. Okay, well, so the consumers had no idea that there was this influence of the music on their actual behavior. So that study strongly suggests that these subtle cues in the environment could have a big impact on a person's behavior. So that's the one study. Another study, going back to classical music, and this is more on the actual consumption. So if you think about wine again, imagine you're at a party and you're drinking wine. There's classical music playing in the background. Well, a study was done like this, where they gave consumers wine to taste, and they either played fast-paced, upbeat dance music, or they played classical music. They played Tchaikovsky, I believe. And what the results showed is that when asked to describe the characteristics of the wine, the characteristics that were used were in line with how you would describe the music. So if there was upbeat dance music, people would say, oh, the flavors are really robust and things like that. Whereas if it was Tchaikovsky, they were more subtle and refined and easy drinking and so on. So again, this is another illustration of how the environment in which the consumer is making a decision, or if there's some kind of consumption experience, that the subtle cues could impact what they perceive, what they feel, and how they behave.
I'm not sure if with the wine and music correlation, we can really stretch that to see if they played Elizabethan music, if the sale of mead would go up.
Yeah, right.
Not quite sure if that would work or not.
But it might be worth looking at yeah. some point. What's the so-called original price trick that we see?
Mm-hmm. The classic pricing phenomenon that we see retailers using, where we have either an original price or a suggested retail price, and then the actual price or the sale price. And the reason that that works so well is that consumers like to have some kind of reference point. So some kind of comparison, some kind of basis for their judgment. And when they have this kind of basis for their judgment, they feel more confident that this is an okay price. So when retailers give consumers that confidence, consumers are more likely to want to purchase it. So imagine if you're buying a gift or you're using a service for something that you've never used before. And that service, in one case or for one group of people, they're told it's $99. Well, I've never used this before. I don't know. Is that a good price? Is that a bad price? I feel a little uncertain. Now, another group of consumers might be told, okay, this is $99 and it's actually holiday special rate. Usually it's $199. Well, that, you can imagine that comparison gives a consumer this feeling of, oh, okay, well, not only am I getting a good deal, but it's a special holiday deal, so I better purchase this right now because it's a limited time offer. Because it's only now. It's probably going to go back to $199 after the holidays. And so those are the kinds of tactics that give consumers a basis for their decision and allow them to feel that confidence that they are making a good decision. So as much as retailers can do that, it's great because a consumer is going to buy.
What about the Black Friday and Boxing Day one-day sales? It's my impression now that Black Friday at the end of November is replacing the December 26th as the big shopping day. But you have to be careful with that day because part of the problem is you don't really get a chance to research spur of the moment whether that's actually a good deal or not. It may appear to be a good deal, but it may not necessarily be. But you've got that one day to either do it or take your chances. Maybe next time you'll get a good deal on it as well.
That's a good point. Anytime we have limited opportunity or one day, it would be good for the consumer to do their research and see comparison shop, compare prices for something that they might be looking for. Imagine somebody's looking for a tablet. If they know ahead of time exactly the specifications, what the prices are at different retailers, then come Black Friday, if there's a sale that is going on, coming with that information to that sale would help make a more informed decision. But unfortunately, many consumers don't do their prior research, and so they get really easily enticed by that feeling that retailers want consumers to have of, well, it's one day and doors open on Thursday at 8 p.m. and they're closed on Friday at midnight. So you have just that limited amount of time to come and clean us out. So that limited time idea is a real big driver for consumers. It's something that really motivates consumers to feel like, I better act right now. And they're more likely to act if they know that that's a limited opportunity. If it's, oh, well, it's our Black Friday sale's gonna be around for the next month. Oh, well, okay, I don't have to go in today. I don't have to make a purchase. I don't have to do anything, right? Because there's no motivation there. So it's that perception of scarcity that really drives a consumer to act.
The urgency is there.
Yes.
They're taking advantage of your sense of urgency. Do it now. It may not be here tomorrow, or if it is, not at that great price that
right.
I see right in front of me. What about university students? I sense that they could be even more susceptible to consumerism because with exams and everything else and leaving to go home if they're from a different city or whatever, there's a lot of pressures on them to get everything done in a very short period of time. And they don't have a lot of money oftentimes available to them. So it must be especially difficult for a lot of university students to cope with this time of the year because of that.
I would definitely agree with that. Most university students are writing exams right now through to the middle of December. So imagine that your last exam is on December 17th. And so now there are only a few days really to get organized and get ready for the holidays before you start visiting with family and friends. So that puts a lot of pressure on students that just by the nature of the limited amount of time in their own lives makes them feel like retailers want you to feel, where, you know, this is your last chance and you better purchase this right now because these deals aren't going to last. And so it's that feeling that students will automatically have. So again, that puts them at a disadvantage in terms of spending, because then they might be less likely to shop around and take their time and look for the best deals and make a more informed decision. Instead, what might happen to students is they might just, oh, well, I only have a couple days, I better go to the mall. And then they get enticed by all of these sights and smells and sounds that will make them want to make a purchase and make them more likely possibly to make a purchase that they didn't necessarily intend on making.
I hope that people don't feel as pressured as they have in the past about spending money that they may not necessarily have. So we'll keep our fingers crossed and hope for the best, but maybe not be the least bit surprised that there's going to be a whole lot of bills coming in the new year.
That's right.
Shall I wish you a Merry Christmas in spite of the consumerism of the season?
Yes.
Thank you very much. How much more Christmas shopping do you have to do, though?
Just a few more gifts.
Okay.
Just a few.
So the pressure is off.
Yes.
Okay,
well,
cool.
I won't let myself feel pressured.
Congratulations. Enjoy the holidays.
Oh, thank you. You too.
That was Brock, Associate Professor of Marketing and Consumer Psychologist Antonia Mantonakis, on the mass consumerism we all face at this time of year and how to avoid falling into the traps retailers lay out for us. As we go through this month, however you celebrate this special time of year, you often hear the politically correct phrase, Happy Holidays. Now, I'm not going to wade into the Happy Holidays versus Merry Christmas debate, at least not this time, but I want to take that first word, happy, and explore that for the next few minutes. We are expected to be happy at this time of year. If we're not, people think there must be something wrong with us. Trouble is, not everyone is actually happy at this time of year for a variety of reasons. The season is not some sort of one-size-fits-all celebration. On the contrary, everyone approaches this holiday season differently, and although the exclamation to have a happy holiday is a natural thing to say for many in December, it just doesn't come naturally to everyone. Brock psychologist Michael Busseri is the university's happiness expert, and when I emailed him last week, he was only too happy to join me in the studio to talk about happiness at this time of year and why some people can't be happy. So I asked him if he's a naturally happy sort.
I think you'd probably have to ask my family and friends and students, and I think so. It's hard to say, and it really, I guess it depends on how we define happiness, which is probably one of the things we'll end up chatting a little bit about. So maybe I'll say somewhat cryptically, maybe.
Okay, hold that thought. What's your least happy thing to do at this time of the year? And I think we all have one.
Yeah, well, maybe we should dive into what happiness means, because I think to answer that question, we sort of have to agree on what that H word is all about. So one of the things that happiness researchers have been trying to figure out over the last 30 or 40 years, really, is when we use the word happiness, what are we talking about? You can imagine that one way to think about happiness is as an emotion. It's something we feel, just like sometimes we might feel excited or angry or sad or stressed. Happiness can be thought of as an emotion. Other people think about happiness more as an evaluation. I'm happy and satisfied with my life. And then a third way that it's studied is in terms of happiness being a sign of meaning and purpose. So from that perspective, a happy person is someone who's doing something that they find meaningful and working towards being all that they can be in terms of developing their skills and abilities. So now to go back to your question, something that I find may not be the most happy experience, I guess it'll depend. If we're looking at it in terms of meaning and purpose, I find tasks that are repetitive and somewhat boring to be not so happy-inducing. And perhaps that's because ultimately those kind of things perhaps might not seem so meaningful while we're doing them. So, for example, if you have a very large stack of dishes at home, you might not find that the most meaningful way to spend 15 or 20 minutes to be washing those dishes. At the same time, some people find washing dishes really relaxing. And so for those 15 or 20 minutes, I'm assuming you have a big stack of dishes, for those 15 or 20 minutes, it might be a very relaxing way to spend your time. You can daydream, you can think about things you want to do with your day. And so in terms of feelings, some people might find it very relaxing. And from that last perspective of thinking about happiness in terms of satisfying, doing something where you think, oh, you know, what I'm doing now really sort of meets my expectations for this moment. Some people might find doing those dishes frustrating because instead of finding it a happy and satisfying event, they're thinking about all the other things they'd much rather be doing. So there's a long answer to a very simple question.
My simple answer to that question, Christmas cards, which comes back to what you said off the top about something being repetitive.
And the repetitive word is really interesting too, because some researchers who study happiness have suggested that even repetitive activities need not necessarily be boring if we can find ways to do it such that we vary it each time. So thinking about those Christmas cards, if you're writing Christmas cards and you're saying the same thing each time, in fact, you're probably taking up the same amount of space in the card and signing your name in the same place, that may not be the most fun experience, but perhaps there's a way to do this such that each card is slightly different. And so each time you go to start it, you're using a different phrase or relating a different experience, and set it such that each card that you write is a unique experience. That's one way, perhaps, to counteract the boredom. Because even the things that we love to do, spending time with family or friends, or going to the gym, or watching our favorite television programs, some research suggests that if we can keep those fresh, then we're more likely to maintain the boosts, those happy boosts that we get from such experiences. So that's why you have sometimes fitness gurus recommending that people vary their workouts, because the muscles get used to doing certain activities in a certain way. And as soon as you switch it up and start challenging your body might grow, whether it's a particular muscle group or the cardiovascular system. But there are boosts to doing the things that we like to do in slightly different ways each time. At least that's what some of the research would suggest in terms of how do we get happy boosts from the things that we end up doing a lot.
What is it about this time of the year that people have trouble with the whole happy aspect of happy holidays?
Happy holidays, Merry Christmas. I think in part there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of pressure for it to be happy and merry and joyous. And, I mean, we see it on all the banners and on the titles for all the television programs and in the malls since October. So in addition to the pressure of the big, long list of gifts that need to be bought and things that need to be done in preparation for the family trip, there's also a shared expectation that Christmas or the holiday period will be a really happy time. So even if it's just relaxing, maybe for some there's a sense of feeling let down that it's not as exciting, it's not as enriched as it might be. And I think that may be because there's so much that we hope to do during this period, including find time to relax and enjoy it. The bar is really high, I think, during a holiday period.
That is the problem, finding the time to relax. For me, my time to relax is basically between Christmas and New Year's. And I think that's the case with a lot of people, because they're going full steam ahead until Christmas Day, and then you've got a day of celebration with friends and family and going places and what have you. By Boxing Day, the last thing I want to do, I may be in the minority here, but the last thing I want to do is to keep rushing by going to the mall.
Yeah, what's really interesting about that observation is some research suggests that one way that people differ is in terms of the kind of experiences they're looking for. Some people really thrive on the high energy environments. And so for them, a positive day or positive experience is something that's really exciting, filled with passion and enthusiasm and all sorts of high energy experiences. Other individuals, myself included, find a positive event where there's time for relaxation, some more calm and some reflection, and to sort of bring the pace down of life a little bit. So by Boxing Day, I'm with you. I'm ready to just kind of downshift a little bit. But there are other individuals who feel a little disappointed by the time we get to Boxing Day because the action more or less is done, and they really thrive in the action. So I would suspect for every person out there who's looking for a relaxing holiday, there are probably just the same number of people who are really loving the fact that right now, a few days before Christmas, they're caught up in the hustle and bustle and excitement of the season. And for them, that's really rewarding and it's a happy time.
I think of the classic Charlie Brown Christmas TV special, which has been around forever, where Charlie Brown laments his inability to find true happiness in all the trappings of the season. In response, Linus says Charlie is the only person who can take a happy time like Christmas and turn it into a problem. Is that the crux of the matter here then?
Well, you know, another way that individuals differ is in terms of how they see life day to day. Some people are really sensitive to the rewards and the positive things in life. And for them, what's really exciting is when things go well, when they meet their goals, when they get rewarded for things that are going well. Other individuals are most concerned with not having a bad day. And so what they're looking to is minimize stress, minimize anxiety, avoid something bad happening. So there may be the Charlie Browns who are most concerned with not getting rained on by missing the puddle, make sure, you know, the football's still there when they go to kick it, and are half expecting things not to work out. Whereas there may be other individuals, perhaps Linus included, who are really keyed to and sensitive to things going right. And what they're looking for is a bunch of positive experiences, as opposed to the Charlie Browns who are most concerned about making sure the bad stuff doesn't happen. We tend to approach life in different ways, and different people see things, literally the same event, in different ways. Some people will see an opportunity for something positive to happen, and other individuals may be more likely to see an opportunity for something wrong to happen, and they're looking to avoid that.
So it's sort of like the glass half empty, half full sort of a thing. It's all a matter of how you approach it and how you view it.
And there's some suggestion that that difference you've just described is to some extent something we're born with. Now, it doesn't mean we're stuck in one way of looking at the world, looking at ourselves, looking at our lives. It simply means that different people, as their first reaction, are likely to see the positives or expect good things to happen, whereas other individuals, their first reaction is, oh, I wonder if this is going to lead to a problem. I'm wondering if the outcome is going to be negative as opposed to positive. And of course, paralleling that kind of research, there's a strong interest in figuring out whether individuals can change their initial reactions, and even if not, can we all find ways to make life more enjoyable and satisfying, even if some of us are predisposed to focus on the negatives or at least be looking to avoid bad things. And so there's research, the focus being, what kinds of things can we do day to day in our lives to maximize whatever level of happiness we do tend to experience over time?
There's also a problem at this time of the year, enforced happiness. We're expected to have a good time. We're expected to be happy. And if we're not, there's something wrong. So is that a problem that people have to deal with, the fact that they're thrust, whether they want to be or not, into a situation where they're forced to enjoy themselves or be happy?
I think that some people would really like that challenge. As I say, the kind of individual who's looking for a lot of excitement and a lot of high energy experiences, I think those kind of individuals would really like the challenge of this kind of year. There's a bunch of stuff that needs to be done. There's a bunch of parties that need to be attended, social events where one needs to show up, presents to be wrapped. There's a lot of buzz, a lot of energy this time of year. But for the individuals who value that or see that as less fun and instead see lots of impediments to getting to do the really relaxing kind of things that they want to do, which may be enjoy a glass of wine while watching one's favorite movie in the comfort of one's own home while the snow is falling. There's lots of impediments to getting to that relaxing moment this kind of year. So those kind of individuals might not see this as a positive challenge, but in fact just a series of hurdles that they have to jump over before they can get to what they'd really like to do, which may be a little more calming and relaxed. But certainly the expectations are part of the challenge, and for other individuals, part of the exciting thing about this time of year.
The family aspect can bring with it a certain number of minefields that we have to tread lightly over. As much as we might wish it so, not everyone has a happy family environment for whatever reason. So although you're expected to have a special time with family at this time of the year, that's not always the case with some people for any number of reasons.
It's true. The social aspect of happiness is a really interesting one, because although researchers have yet to pinpoint one or two essential ingredients to happiness, regardless of how happiness is defined, it is clear that people with really strong social connections tend to be the ones who say that their lives are most meaningful and satisfying. In fact, some researchers have even proposed that it's very unlikely to find a happy hermit. Personally, I think that's a little strong. I know individuals who seem to be very satisfied and happy to the extent that everyone just leaves them alone, which of course raises complications when the expectation is we get together with family, as you say. I think the family-related situations is one way to illustrate the different types of happiness. So if a family situation over the Christmas holidays tends to be stressful for whatever reason, some might consider that a not very happy experience, an unhappy moment. Can't wait to be done with this so I can leave. Other individuals might find that experience, even if it is somewhat stressful, a meaningful one. Perhaps they recognize that Aunt Emma or Grandpa Joe aren't going to be with us that much longer. And even if it's hard to spend time with him or her, this is a meaningful experience because we're adding to the family history. We're sharing our time with someone. And we think that that's an important and valuable, virtuous way to spend one's time. And so one can leave a situation like that thinking, even if it wasn't the most fun experience of the week or the holiday, it certainly is a meaningful experience. And in that sense, it's satisfying and valuable.
I wanted to talk about a relatively new phenomena outside of the family aspect of the holidays, and that's the Facebook aspect. I'm noticing this holiday season, when I'm on Facebook, you're getting the people who are really into the season, and they're posting inspirational messages, funny pictures, that sort of thing. And then you got the other ones who are, well, I'm just not feeling great today. So you're taking your feelings and you're putting them in a very public forum. And I wonder if that's a new phenomenon that we're just going to have to deal with in the future. The fact that people are burying their souls, as it were, on Facebook and other social media. And that's something that we didn't have to face maybe 10 years ago.
You may be right. One of the really interesting things about social media is that people get to choose the profile, literally the profile, the image of themselves that they wish to present, whether it's moment-to-moment tweeting, whether it's photos that they tend to, or videos that they post through social media. But ultimately, all of this amounts to the same thing, people sort of creating a particular image of themselves that they get to share. So on the one hand, there's a lot of choice and freedom to create an image of oneself and share that with the world. Whereas you say, you know, even 10 years ago, if you wanted to share a particular image of yourself, you'd have to copy a photo and literally send the physical photo to family and friends. No one does that anymore, of course. Everything's posted and shared and tagged. So I can see the opportunity for individuals to have a lot more control over how they present themselves to the world. And that must be really freeing for people who place a lot of value in that. On the other hand, much like when we listen to the news or read an editorial in a newspaper, we have to keep in mind that there's some decision-making from whoever is presenting this information. There's some decision-making about what's being presented and how it's going to be shown. And so whether or not that reflects the true person, I guess, is up for debate. And it may be that if you followed a particular individual over enough time, you might get a true sense of their particular character, even if the conclusion ultimately is, well, here's someone who likes to be constantly changing how they're presenting themselves to the world. I think it's a really interesting social experiment, and I think there are lots of opportunities for us to learn things about each other that we never knew before. Now, I suppose the question could be raised whether we want to know some of the information that's being shared. But in terms of the holiday season and thinking about happiness, it certainly gives us insights into the lives of individuals that historically we've never had before. Back in the 80s, researchers started giving people diaries that they'd asked to fill out and then send into the researchers every couple of months, and we call those daily diary studies. And then we got into beeper studies, where we gave someone a beeper and we'd beep them maybe half a dozen times during the day, and every time they got the beep, they'd have to write down their thoughts and feelings. So those beeper studies were designed to give us insights into what people were thinking and feeling as they were living their lives. Well, now we don't need the daily diaries, we don't need the beepers, we just need to go online and we can follow famous people if we want to, friends and family, to find out sometimes moment to moment what they're thinking and what they're feeling and what they're experiencing in their lives, which is, I think, a really fascinating point in history because we're gaining insight into the lives of individuals that we never would have been able to do even 5 or 10 years ago.
So to put the season in perspective, what should people do to manage their emotions and their feelings at this time of the year? And for want of a better expression, maintain a happy state of mind, if you will.
Well, ultimately, I think The answer to that is going to differ for every single individual. And if we think about happiness as a series of ingredients, those key ingredients are probably going to differ, or at least the combination differ for each individual. But one thing I think we can do is think about holidays as an opportunity to make some choices, choices as to how we spend our time that we may not have in a regular work week. So even if we're off just for 3 or 4 days over the holidays, one thing people could do is ask themselves, of the various ways to think about happiness, what's most important to them? Are they looking for a lot of moments of joy and excitement? Are they looking for moments of calm and relaxation? Are they looking to get involved with activities that they think have a lot of meaning and purpose? So, for example, maybe volunteering or do things that seem a little more selfless and may not be the most exciting things, but yet they're contributing to the good of society, for example. Or whether we're looking to have satisfying experiences where we have certain things we hope to get out of it and we achieve those things. I think if people can identify what's most important to them, then we're one step closer, and they're one step closer to figuring out how to bring more of that into their lives. So people looking for excitement can identify that as something they value, find ways to nurture that throughout the holiday. People looking for calm and relaxation can perhaps try to find at least a couple of afternoons or evenings where they're able to claim that this is a night that I'm not going to book something because I know I need an opportunity to put my feet up. And people who really value doing something purposeful and meaningful, even if it's not super happy time, perhaps they're able to find those opportunities to engage in those activities during the holiday too. I think we can make choices, and to the extent that we have time to reflect even just a little bit on what's most valuable to us, I think that'll bring us one step closer to making some choices that maybe can boost our happiness, even if it's just for the matter of an afternoon or an evening.
We thank you very much for coming in today, Professor Busseri, and I wish you happy holidays.
And to you. You're very welcome. Thanks for having me in.
That was Brock psychologist Michael Busseri, the university's so-called happiness expert on how to stay happy over the holidays. This is Inquisitive Minds on CFBU-FM. I'm your host, Mike Saunders. Along with the coming season of Christmas, we have just begun the ancient Roman celebration of Saturnalia, which began December 17th. In fact, it runs through to December 23rd and honors the deity Saturn. But who actually celebrates Saturnalia anymore? People don't usually parade around at toga parties in full Roman regalia in honor of Saturn, do they? Maybe I'm just running with the wrong crowd. Better make that walking. I recently had a chance to sit down and chat with our CFBU studios with historian Fanny Dolansky, associate professor in the Department of Classics, specializing in Roman social history and Latin literature at Brock, who has done extensive research on the Saturnalia festival. I asked Professor Dolansky about the origins of Saturnalia.
Well, the earliest references that we have in ancient literature are to about the mid-3rd century BCE, so that's about 2.5 centuries or so before the birth of Jesus or Julius Caesar, however you want to think about it. But it seems like the festival probably was actually earlier than that, so may go back to sort of the earliest times of the Roman Republic, so around 500 BCE, so quite a long history.
So who or what was Saturn, and why do we name a festival after Saturn to begin with?
The festival really is related to its origin seemed to be agricultural, but Saturn was associated with a golden age, a time when there was no slavery, when there was abundance, and sort of an equaling of the levels. And so that relates to the relationships between masters and slaves, which I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about later. But Saturn's really associated with that golden age and agricultural abundance, and that's the heart of the festival, is that sort of an origin.
Was it originally a one-day festival that eventually expanded to several days, or was it like the modern-day Boxing Day that ended up being a boxing week?
That's an excellent question. It seems as though the original festival was actually 7 days long. And over the span of approximately nearly a millennium of history, the festival went from 7 days down to 3 days under certain emperors, back up to 5, and then eventually back up to 7. So it never seems to have been a single-day festival. And that's actually true about most Roman festivals. There are very few that were one-day affairs, unlike our modern Jewish or Christian festivals that are sort of more time-limited.
Now, would the Julian calendar factor have affected that at all?
Not at all. That's something that wouldn't have had an impact. Instead, it seems to have been the case that certain emperors, for a variety of reasons, and I could get into that later if you wanted, but for a variety of reasons that emperors truncated the length of the festival or extended it back again.
Now, the aspect of role reversal we touched on a moment ago between masters and slaves during Saturnalia is probably what most people remember about the festival, if they know anything at all about Saturnalia. How did that aspect come about?
My theory is that the reason why this is so necessary is because in a slaveholding society, there has to be some sort of safety valve or mechanism for slaves letting off some of the steam that must have come from being constantly enslaved. Slavery was always a violent institution, and even the best treated slaves, perhaps in domestic households where they might have had a bit of a better lifestyle than, say, slaves in the mine, certainly would have needed some sort of opportunity to have a break from it. And it seems as though, from what ancient authors write, that they recognize that slaves needed some sort of a reward for their work and an incentive to keep on working. And so a holiday, which gave them a bit of a break, an opportunity to sort of have temporary freedom, was a way to continue to maintain the institution of slavery without slaves rebelling and simply objecting to this and some sort of violent insurrection.
So basically it was like an olive branch dangled in front of the slaves. Okay, we're going to treat you really well for this period of time, so long as you behave the rest of the year.
Absolutely. And if you look at literature from the antebellum South regarding slaves celebrating holidays, that's the perspective certainly that former slaves take, that holidays seemed at the time like great opportunities to drink and revel and have a good time, but that in reality, it just forced slaves to become more comfortable with the institution of slavery and to go back to being slaves after the holiday ended.
The slaves obviously would enjoy this role reversal. I'm trying to think of the proper word to use. How mercenary would they become with their masters? Okay, here's my chance to stick it to the boss. So how carried away would they necessarily get?
It's an excellent question. Unfortunately, we have almost no literature from the ancient world written from the pen of a slave. So the perspective that we always have is from masters. That said, it seems as though there were certain games and ways in which the holiday was set up to allow slaves to have that opportunity to, as you might put it, to sort of stick it to the master temporarily. But this idea of a complete role reversal and a total abandonment of norms is simply not accurate. I mean, slaves may have enjoyed themselves at the party and feasted, but some slaves were still preparing that feast. So there was never this sense of complete and utter freedom. I think the master was always in charge, even if slaves were allowed to push the limits. And we know from literature that slaves were allowed to speak freely and tease their masters and gamble and drink and do things that they weren't normally allowed to do, but always within a limit.
And obviously they would have to think, okay, when this is all over, we go back to normal. If I really rub him the wrong way, he's going to make life difficult for me afterwards.
I think you're absolutely right. And in fact, some ancient literature from the perspective, again, of masters, sort of invite slaves to have a good time, but don't forget that the whips come back out. Literally, the whips come back out after the seventh day is over. So there's this sense that you can have fun, but remember, tomorrow we go back to the norm. And I think you're right that if slaves pushed it too much beyond, whatever the holiday limits, that there was probably some payback could be coming down the line afterwards.
So probably no sign of the medieval whoopee cushion. That probably wouldn't have shown up during the Saturnalia festival.
I don't know. Certainly the holiday was largely about two things, license and levity. And we know that the food in some households was kind of off the wall and, sort of creative things, maybe things that weren't even supposed to be edible. And also that people exchanged gifts that seem to have often been sort of gag gifts, especially among the elite and among elite males. And so sort of your whoopee cushion type of idea. I mean, we have a whole book of little poems that seem to be gift tags. And some scholars suggest that these were all gifts for men. And so, why were men receiving things like breast wraps and wigs and hair dye if they're not meant to be gag gifts?
Fair enough. I was wondering about how much revelry would be part of the celebration. Obviously, there would be a lot of feasting and lessening of the rules and what have you. But would it become a veritable bacchanalia, or would it be a little more subdued than that?
I think it really depends on the particular household. For one thing, we need to think about diverse households in terms of sizes. Some households where a master might not even be present for the celebration. And so if it's just slaves celebrating, how wild are they going to get if there's no master there to poke fun at? But one of the big components of the festival was a revel, was a drinking banquet with all sorts of games, dancing girls, shenanigans of a variety of sorts. And so I think things might have gotten quite out of control, certainly for upper class men and their slaves with drinking and some of these antics.
Well, that would be a trusting master if he leaves the house in the hands of the reveling slaves and he's away, assuming that everything's going to be fine when he comes home. I don't know if I would I would go that far. I think I would want to be there and see what's going on and take the jabs.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because for one thing, many elite masters, if we think about some of the names that might come to mind from antiquity, people like Cicero, for example, would have owned several houses with slave households. So he couldn't possibly be in five or six places at once. And so there were always going to be households where slaves were celebrating without the master present. But what we know from masters is that some of them consciously wanted to avoid the very situation of having to celebrate the holiday with their slaves. So it's a bit of a paradox. It's a holiday that's supposed to celebrate temporary freedom and master and slave relationships, but then we have masters who specifically write about getting out of the city and going to their country villa to avoid having to spend time with the slaves or having a little hideaway. One author writes about having, you know, a huge villa where he has a little room upstairs that's so far away that he can't even hear the voices of the slave children on the Saturnalia. So as I said, there's a bit of a paradox there. Not everybody wanted to take the jabs.
Would it be fair to compare it to what we see nowadays during Mardi Gras, the real big celebration?
I think there are certainly some similarities. I always think of Mardi Gras as being a very public holiday in nature. People go out on the street, the sexes mix. And I think that the Saturnalia was in many ways much more contained in the sense that people celebrated at home. So there wasn't sort of the public dimension of the same sort. But I think there are some similarities in terms of sort of people really truly letting their hair down and having a good time and the drinking and sort of atmosphere of levity and license.
Is there any kind of a religious aspect to Saturnalia at all? Or was it like Mardi Gras? It's like a grand national drunk, and then when it's all over, you sort of find the wherewithal to drag yourself to church on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day.
No, absolutely there's a religious element. In fact, all Roman holidays are religious fundamentally. So the Saturnalia we know began with a public sacrifice to Saturn, may have taken place in the Forum, probably in the Temple of Saturn. It would have depended on particular cities and different locations around the empire, but certainly began with a religious component with the sacrifice. There would have been sacrifices at the dinner table before people ate. There may have been sacrifices throughout the holiday. So always with this background of religious observance, but of course lots of feasting and drinking to go along with it. Perhaps not unlike the way many people celebrate Christmas or Thanksgiving, where there's a religious component, but there's also lots of fun that people might say is secular or at least less religious in nature.
Yeah, I was curious about how many of our traditions now, when we celebrate Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, New Year's Eve, New Year's Day, how many of those are rooted in Saturnalia? What's the parallel we can draw between the two?
I think one of the connections is with the gift giving, and that connects both with Christmas and particularly with Boxing Day. There are a number of theories, and there's lots of scholarly debate about the origins of Boxing Day, but the idea, some scholars have suggested that even Boxing Day comes from the idea of masters, particularly in the British Empire, offering their servants boxed gifts on Boxing Day and sort of giving them the day off. Sometimes people talk about a servants' ball where the master and his family wait on the servants, and the servants sort of enjoy this temporary experience of what it's like to be the master. And those seem to me to have their origins in the Saturnalia. The feasting, many holidays, pagan, Christian, Jewish, and so forth, have feasting as an element. Does that go back to the Saturnalia? It's entirely possible. As for New Year's, that's a little trickier because the Roman New Year was originally March 1st. Later on in the empire, it switched to January 1st. I'm not sure about how many of our modern New Year's antics actually can be tied back to the ancient world.
I was reading about Parentalia, the other festival, if you will. What's the difference between Saturnalia and Parentalia?
Oh, these are radically different festivals. For one thing, actually, the Romans had a very rich festival calendar, so it's sometimes hard for us as moderns to think about a society in which numerous days of the calendar year would be taken up with holidays. But in any case, the Parentalia was celebrated in mid-February. It lasted for 9 days, and it was actually a festival very different from the Saturnalia in that it was devoted to commemorating the dead, and particularly the family dead. And so families would go out to the cemeteries on the outskirts of town, bring offerings to their dead, maybe have a picnic there, and celebrate the lives that they've lost, and also look forward to the family continuing in the future. So a very different tone and focus.
Okay. Now, how different are we, really, from the ancient Romans? Like, when we're talking about all this revelry and and we're matching it up between Saturnalia and our holiday season now. Are we really all that different from our Roman ancestors when you come right down to it?
I think you're right that there are a lot of similarities in that people are looking for an opportunity to, as I said before, to sort of let their hair down, let their guard down, relax a little bit, overdo it, right? Indulge in terms of feasting, indulge in terms of drinking, maybe let some of the hierarchy and the norms sort of relax a little bit for that period. So I think there are many similarities. In fact, I've always thought as a Roman historian that there are many areas in which we're not so different as 21st century Canadians than the Romans were over 2,000 years ago.
But there are decidedly less toga parties now than there used to be many, many years ago, I would think.
Certainly in Canada. It's too cold for too many toga parties.
Does anybody actually celebrate Saturnalia anymore?
You know, I don't know that people do in sort of the true nature of the Roman celebration. Certainly people have parties, as you suggest. We had one in the classics department and a couple of weeks ago for students and faculty, although faculty didn't wait on students, but we provided most of the food and some of the non-alcoholic drinks, so maybe that accords with the festival. But I don't think anyone celebrates it in sort of the true sense, in part because thankfully in North America, the institution of slavery has long been abolished, and so there isn't sort of that dynamic. But the sort of the relaxation, I suppose, that gets combined into people's celebrations around that time of the year.
So there was no toga party up at Brock?
No, there wasn't.
For which we're all grateful, I'm sure. Would it be appropriate if saying Merry Christmas is deemed politically correct in this day and age to wish someone a happy Saturnalia? Is that permissible?
Today?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't see why not. I mean, if people feel that their beliefs and their principles align with those of the ancient Romans and the Saturnalia, then I think there's nothing wrong with that.
All right. Well, on that note, then I will wish you a happy Saturnalia and thank you very much for enlightening us on this. It's fascinating to draw the correlation between our celebrations in modern times and the origins that go all the way back to the Romans.
Thank you. Today, in fact, is the very first day of the Saturnalia. It stretches on another 3 to 5 to 7 days, depending on your perspective. So thank you.
Let the revelry begin.
And the revelry is already underway, in fact, as the Saturnalia Festival began December 17th. We spoke there with historian Fanny Dolansky, associate professor in the Department of Classics, specializing in Roman social history and Latin literature, up at Brock University. Happy Saturnalia. Just not used to even saying it, let alone celebrating it. That's it for this edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFBU FM 103.7 in St. Catharines. My name is Mike Saunders, and I hope you've enjoyed the show. You can contact me via email at any time at talk@cfbu.ca with show comments and suggestions. This is the last show before Christmas and New Year's. The next 2 weeks will be repeat broadcasts of the show for Christmas Day and New Year's Day. So I'd like to take this opportunity to wish you a most joyous season, however and with whomever you choose to celebrate. Until next year, happy holidays, and always remember to have an inquisitive mind. The next.